everyone. My name's Hallie Applebaum, and I'm the founder of Future of Women. You are listening to a recent conversation I had with Dr. Cécile Montel, a French emergency room physician based in Paris.
I've also been following what you've been doing, and I was just so inspired, and I thought, of course, always rising to the occasion.
Yeah, I'm good. Now, I do have to say that life is really easy compared to what we've been through. I'm working half of the time. The rest of the time, I'm doing remote work. I get to run. I get to go in the sun. Because the time kind of had stopped, I had no idea what day we were when. We were confined on the 18th of March. I think I was sent to the adult department around the 20-something. It stayed open for at least a month. So I would say until the end of April. After we were over the peak and it went down quite fast. I was on the front for like a full month and it was quite intense.
Not only have you been on the front lines, but you're someone who is constantly innovating with how you bring physicians together or how you use technology. 3 years ago, I was so inspired by women's stories in different countries that I traveled to that I wanted to create a platform to tell women's stories. Over the past few years, have been hosting all of these different women's events, breakfasts in Los Angeles and Mexico City and Tokyo, around everything from like journalism to the culinary world to cannabis to human rights and art. When coronavirus happened, events were no longer possible. I thought, let me record some of these conversations with women who are living in different places to hear what their candid experience has been over the past few months. And so, of course, you came to mind. Where in France are you from?
I was born in Paris, raised in Paris. And when I was 14, my dad moved to the US to take his startup over there. That was in 1998. So we moved to San Francisco. I did all my high school over there. I stayed one extra year and I went to San Jose State University because I just had no idea like what I wanted to do. I liked biology, but I was a very average student. I was never top of my class, wasn't at the bottom either, but was more of the talkative, want to go out, party rather than study kind of teen. So because I had skipped a class when I was younger than everybody else. And I was like, well, I'll just try, you know, the US university just to see. And I like biology. So I picked a major in microbiology. And for a year, never took a microbiology class, but I had fun stuff. I mean, I did have chemistry, but after it was like sociology, I had a class called like recreation. That was so weird. Anyway, I did that for a year. And then I was like, okay, where am I going? The French education system is quite advanced. And so I felt I was losing my time. So I was like, well, I'll just go back to France and then maybe I'll come back to the US for like a PhD or something. And so I went back to France. I did pharmacy school. I was like, okay, if I do pharmacy school, then maybe after I can do a business degree on top of it. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was like, well, I know I don't want to work now. I want to study for a very long time, keep all the doors open. So went back to France, went into pharmacy school. And then I went to a city that's south of France called Toulouse. I had never been there before, but when I got back, I was very lazy. So I knew things were harder in Paris. So I was like, okay, I don't want to go to Paris because I don't want to study too much. So I was like, I want sun and I want to have young people around me. So people told me, oh, just go to Toulouse. I was like, sure. So I went there and I had one cousin who was over there who got me into that pageant contest just because I was a tomboy. I would never wear makeup. I would wear caterpillar shoes. And she was like, yeah, you don't have balls, you know, you can't do that. And I was like, fuck you, I'll do it, you know. And so I did the pageant contest and she was not even there. I was by myself. It was so ridiculous. And then I won and I was like, wait, what? I mean, that was a bet. Like, you know, it wasn't serious. Like, I'm not supposed to win. It was a small pageant contest, but then you had to go to the regional pageant contest. And I just had moved to France. I just had moved from 4 years in the States. I did not know the city. I was not from that city. And I was like, okay, I did the bet, you know, I actually won the bet. I also won the contest. And then I remember my mom telling me, well, you know, just go to the next one. And I was like, well, if I go to the next one just for the experience, then I'm going to make myself ineligible. And she was like, my daughter, you know, I love you so much and I find you very beautiful, but I find you beautiful because you're my daughter. You're never going to win. And I was 18 back then. So I was like, okay, you know, like your mom tells you you're never going to win. Sure, I went for the experience just because, you know, like to see, it wasn't my style, but like it was just fun to see. I just felt outside of the box. And so I went to that second one and then I won again. Wow. And then I knew no one in the hall. There was 800 people and I knew no one. And I was like, this is wrong. The girls, they ask all their friends, all their family to come vote for them. I'm not supposed to be elected. And then on that night, I remember crying. I was like, why is this happening to me? Like, I came back to France to study. I'm not a pageant. I hate it. I don't even find myself pretty. Like, this was a bet, you know? And then the next stage was to go to the national pageant. And my parents were like, well, this is really weird. We know it's not you. We know it's not your style. We know it's not what you like. But why is this happening to you? You know, maybe you should go. Maybe you're going to see the media world, you're going to see the TV world. For 1 year, you're still young. Just maybe you just go for it. And so I ended up doing the whole stuff. Although for the national contest, I made sure I was ineligible because, you know, it was fun, but like not too much fun. I mean, I wouldn't have to like smile every day and wear other people's clothes and never be able to say what I think. But I still go for the ride. And then after, for 1 year, you have to like, be a model. So I did this and it was horrible. Everybody was looking at me with like weird eye. I become like paranoid. I had no more friends because I knew no one in that city where I just had moved. And then in pharmacy school, everybody knew me because of course you're on the head of the newspaper. I didn't want to have friends because I felt they were not coming to me for myself, but they were coming to me because I was that pageant. And it was really horrible. And then during the year, I was like, okay, what do I want to do with my life? I like biology. Pharmacy school, I don't want to go there anymore. I don't want to see the people. So I'm just going to go to med school so I can do research. And then once I'm a doctor, I can choose anything, right? It's kind of the best path for a researcher. So the year after, I got into med school. It's an exam in France. Basically, anybody can get in med school, but at the end of the first year, they only take the top percent. And so you work a lot for that exam and you don't really think about what's after. So anyway, I studied, I got into med school. And then once I was in med school, I was like, oh my God, why did you do? You hate blood. You've never want to be a doctor ever. When I was a kid, I did not know what I wanted to do, but I would always tell people, I won't be a doctor or a lawyer because that's what everybody wanted to do. So of course I did not want to do what everybody wanted to do. And then here I was in med school, hating blood, not wanting to be a doctor, just to do research. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have to go through 10 years of study to do research, 10 years of like doing what I don't want to do. Anyway, and so I went to my first internship, so in second year of med school, and then something happened. I don't know where that came from, but from the moment I saw my first patient, I just fell in love with the job. I would have never, ever think that I would like it. You would have asked me before, you're going to be a doctor later. I would have been like, no, I'll put my hand on the fire. I will never be a doctor. But I get that until you experience something, you cannot know what it is. Young people, they have ideas about jobs, what they want to do in life, and what they like and they don't like. But I think that until you actually face those things, you can't know if you're going to like it or not. I would have never thought that I would have loved it, but I did. I loved it. I really fell in love with the job. And like, it was so evident. It was like, I was made for that. Like, this is me. Like, this is not a job. This is who I am. This is what I want to be. So I've been through med school. And because I had lived in the States, I wasn't a geek, but it's just that the States had internet, they had email address, like in the university, you had to like type your classes on a computer, you had to like do research. It wasn't Google back then. But anyway, like we were already chatting, it was like ICQ and all those stuff. And in France was not there yet, but it was starting. And in the medical field, you would hear a lot about how internet was evil. Patients should not go there to look for information. We're having algorithm who wants to replace doctor, and that's not a good thing. And I was like, guys, you're missing it. Sure, the information that's right now on the internet back then, it was pretty shitty. But I was like, it doesn't matter. What matters is the concept that all of a sudden, that information is available somewhere and you can do something with it. And so I thought they're wrong. Like the internet is not evil and all those new technologies are not evil. We need to grab them and make medicine better. I thought to myself, and I'm a bit hyper, I can't stand doing just one thing. So I was like, well, I just have a dual career. I want to be a doctor, but I also want to bring technology to the medical field. And so once I was done with med school, I went through a residency. I did GP, which is family medicine, because it's a shortest residency. It's what opens the most doors for me. That was the easiest way to have that dual career. So I did my residency. That's when I got into Sandbox.
Sandbox is a global community for young entrepreneurs, and that's the way that Cecile and I first connected. We're about 1,000 people around the world. I was part of the London hub and she was part of the Paris hub. It's a community of people across industries, from the arts to the sciences, all doing really creative things in their fields.
I had all those ideas about e-health, but it didn't really exist back then in France. And all my friends in med school thought I was crazy. You know, they were like, why don't you want to be a normal doctor? Why would you go work for a company, not just the hospital? When I got into Sandbox, all of a sudden, everything shifted from people calling me crazy to people telling me, wow, that's awesome. You should meet that person or you should look into that company. For me, it was a revelation. I think it really changed the course of my life. And without Sandbox, I would not be where I'm at today. And most likely, I would just be a regular doctor doing my regular job. So once I was done with residency, I took a job as a GP. I took a job in the pediatric ER as well. And I just went and knocked on doors of startups. But back then, nobody was talking about startups. Like, startup wasn't cool. Being an entrepreneur was not cool yet. E-health, nobody knew that word in France. So I was just like knocking on doors of small companies and telling them, hi, you guys are building healthcare products and the idea is good, you know, but you're developing by yourself and the end product is often not adapted for clinical practice because you guys are not talking to doctors and healthcare workers. So here I am. Would you have a job for me? And I finally found a job in a startup. I had three jobs, like the GP, the emergency room for kids and the startup. And I did that for a while. Kind of got burned out because I remember for a year, I did not have one single day of vacation. Even on Christmas Day, I was working. So I was like, okay, this is not going to work. So I dropped the GP job just to keep the ER, the pediatric emergency room, and the startup job. And then I did that for 2 years. And then I was like, wow, like I'm doing what I want.
I love your story. This is so inspiring.
I did that for 2 years. And so I was very happy because I felt I was doing exactly what I wanted. At the same time, I started speaking at conferences and in the media. Sometimes people are like, is it hard for a woman? And I was like, well, actually, I have a super high positive bias in the e-health field. In France, it was only guys. So because you had a woman young who has a big mouth, everybody would call me. So I was very lucky and actually it was a big advantage to be that kind of person. So anyway, I was speaking at conferences. And one time I remember I spoke at that big, like, it was named, I think it was like Future of Medicine or something. And you had people from Singularity University, from the US. It was that big conference with 1,000 people. People were telling me, you have everybody. You have VCs, you have the pharmaceutical industry, you have all your startups. I remember looking at them and telling them, guys, you have zero healthcare professional in that room. How can you be pretending that that conference is about the future of medicine if you don't have doctors? There's no physicians. There's just companies. This doesn't work. You can't do it without them. And patients, of course, as well. And I was like, okay, I'm actually doing what I like. But if I'm alone, the doctor on that bridge between tech and medicine, I'm not going to go anywhere. So that's where I got the idea to start an NGO. Actually, I mean, yes, it is an NGO, but really it's a Facebook group. So I started that Facebook group where I just put my doctor's friends and my entrepreneur's friends, like a developer, designer, you know, like people I would just know from a bit everywhere in the either healthcare field or technology field. And I started sharing articles that I would find online about healthcare and new technologies. Kind of picked up really good, like a lot of people subscribe. And for me, it was a way to have those two world talk to each other. Because in real life, they never get to meet, they never get to talk. On one side, you have doctors and they have great ideas for technologies. They know the applications of technologies, but because they're doctors, they don't know anything about tech and they don't know anything about business. So their ideas always stays ideas. They never go anywhere. And on the other side, you have those tech people and entrepreneurs and they have ideas about healthcare, everybody has, but then they have like the business skills and the tech skills. So they're building products, but because they're not talking to the healthcare field, it's the wrong products. to me, it was really a way to have those two worlds connect. And I did not want to do a website, because on a website, you have to have a login and a password. And doctors, they don't do that. They would have never taken the step to do that. So by just having them from Facebook, they just have to click on join and that's it. And they can just read what I'm posting. And they don't have to answer. They don't have to ask questions if they don't want to. But at least they're seeing what's going on. And so really picked up. Co-founders found each other. Doctors found consulting jobs in startups. Like, it was very, very, very fertile. I had young doctors writing to me how they discovered the group and were inspired to like have a dual career as well. So that was great. I felt much better doing this. So I was doing that on the side. And then I started having a lot of offers because my profile was so weird. I was probably the first one, or maybe we were like five doctors who both had a fit in tech and healthcare. So like, I started to get offering from everywhere, like VCs, media. I took on a few jobs on the side, as if I were not working enough, but anyway. So I also did a blog for a media. I did a web show, 2 seasons about smartphone apps for doctors. I got into ethical committees of challenges, foundations, a whole bunch of random thing. And I really liked it because I was just discovering new worlds all the time. So that was kind of fun. People always ask me, what did you study? Actually, I helped create a diploma on eHealth. I give classes. On my side, how did I learn? I remember the first time I worked for a startup, I remember hearing about a BP. And I was like, what the fuck is a BP? For me, it's blood pressure. What is a business plan? What are you guys talking about? Do you want me to like use medical acronyms in front of you also? And I knew nothing. I had no idea about all those stuff, but hey, once you're in the thing, you just got to learn. And that's how I did it. Yeah, I did that for a while. And then after I left the startup, and then that's when I got my job at the university. So I now manage a healthcare simulation platform, which is public, not a company, it's really a university. And we welcome healthcare students and healthcare professionals, and they get to train on those mannequins and computers. They get to train themselves on technical gestures and on how to take in charge a patient and how to talk and communicate with a patient. I always say we learn everything in a box, and then, you know, you have to go to real life, and then all of a sudden you have a patient in front of you, and it's not because you learn something in a book that you know how to do it in real life. It's not because you learn how to perform like a lumbar puncture. You know, it's not because you read a bit about it that you know how to do it. So we have mannequins to train students to do that. Or it's not because you learn in 3 sentences that you should announce a cancer disease with like empathy. This is not because you read that you have to announce it with empathy that you know how to do it. So we train them with actors, comedians who come and play the role of the patient. It's not because you learn about the dosage of adrenaline during a cardiac arrest that you know how to manage a cardiac arrest in real life. I mean, it's much more than that. You have a team, you have to be able to be a leader, you have to know where the emergency cart is, you have to know about how to position people and who's doing what and when. That's what we teach them in our department. So that's half of my time, and I still have the pediatric ear on the side. I'm still giving conferences. Most of the time, I mean, I also did consulting for startups. I did consulting for like huge companies. I don't know. I did so many things. Like, I mean, I had like 1,000 lives in one life.
How did you decide to focus on pediatrics?
Oh, so, okay. I mean, I always say I didn't decide. It just picked me. Like, so when I was a resident, I had an internship in the department I work for now, in the pediatric ER department. I've always loved kids, but I've never thought about being a pediatrician because the pediatric residency was longer and you had to go through like a hospital career. And like, I did not want this. That was not my thing, to be in a box and like all those protocols and hierarchy and all those stuff. So I just had never thought about it. And then once I was in the ER, I loved the job. Like I just loved it. And I was like, oh my God, I should have chosen the pediatric, you know, residency. And I told myself, no, Cecile, like you didn't. It's okay. Like there must be a reason. Just, it's fine how it is. And then at the end of the internship, the head of the department came to see me and he offered me a job. And I was like, I can't take the job. I'm not a pediatrician. Like I did not do the pediatric residency. And he was like, that's okay. And I'm like, no, you don't get it. I did not even do the ER diploma. Nothing. I'm just a GP. I don't have the diplomas. You're not supposed to hire me. This is forbidden by law. And he was like, yeah, then, you know, that's okay. Just sign at the bottom of the page. I was like, okay. I just hacked it. I love my job. I don't know. This is just part of who I am. And I love work and I love going to work.
At that point, did you already have a kid?
No. Clara is, she's going to be 3 years old. And I finished my residency in 2014. So I did not have a kid.
Then what was it like knowing what you knew from being in an ER and focusing on pediatrics and then having a child of your own? Oh, yeah. Like what was that transition like? Where did you almost like know too much for your own good, or you felt very secure because you did know so much?
Yeah. So the funny thing is, so I started and I had no kid, and I remember having those moms of like 4 kids asking me for advice and seeing myself giving them advice. And I was like, I don't even have a kid, you know, and I'm giving advice to all those moms, you know, and I don't even have one. I got mine. I'm not a very stressed person. Like, I'm pretty laid back, I guess. So it was amazing. Like, I loved being pregnant. And then once I had my kid, I knew how to take care of her instantly. I mean, of course, like, that's kind of my job. So I never got scared. I was confident right away. But what I saw through this is how hard it must be for parents who don't have the knowledge that I have. I was lucky because I knew everything, but I was realizing that you are not surrounded by people who are helping you a lot. I mean, you see sometimes a bit of, you know, you see the midwives a bit and she teaches you how to breastfeed for an hour, but that doesn't teach you to be a parent. I remember being, you know, at the maternity and giving Clara's first bath with my husband. And of course I knew how to do it. So I was like, well, you know, you do it. And that girl was explaining to him, and it's complicated when you never did it. And I was like, gosh, if that's how we had to go home and I didn't know how to do it, he would never remember.
Did he pick it up?
No, of course, I was here. But when you think that both parents have no clue how to take care of a baby, it must be so frightening to go home with that baby. And people showed you one time how to give a bath. They stress you with like breastfeeding. You don't know anything. So I consider myself super, super, super lucky. And that's why, like, I mean, all of my friends, they know that I answer all the time and they're always texting me and they know there is no stupid question, because I always tell them, like, I'm so happy if I can help you, because I can sense how difficult it must be when you don't have the competencies that I have because of my job. When moms talk, I often shut up because my daughter is so freaking easy that I'm ashamed, you know, because she always slept. I was never tired. People are like, oh, we're going to come and visit you, but, you know, we won't stay long. And I was like, why? Well, we don't want to, you must be tired. I was like, no, like, I'm super in shape. I never got tired. I always slept. She was so good. She would never cry. Breastfeeding was like super easy. She was sleeping full nights after like 3 months. She ate perfect. I mean, she never had like a diaper rash. She never got sick. She's so freaking easy. It's not even normal, because I knew how to do it. Like, I was very lucky. After, I have some doctor friends and they're more stressed, like as a personality, and it doesn't go so well with all the moms. But with me, I do have to say, like, maybe the next one will be terrible, right? I mean, I have no idea. But
Cecile, you're like a superwoman. This is incredible.
I'm not. I have, you know, I know from the outside sometimes, like, I realize that people must be like, wow, how is she doing all of that? But just like everybody else, I just have 24-hour day. And then I have an amazing husband. Like, when we got a kid, I was like, okay, for having a kid, it's 50-50. And at the time, he had his own company with like 20 people, and he was raising like a Series A. So we had Clara on June 5th. On June 6th, he was signing an $8 million deal for his company. So it was like we had 2 babies at the same time. But anyway, I told him, this is 50-50. I do not care that you are a CEO. It's 50-50. Otherwise, I'm not having that baby. And so he's been super involved from the beginning. He takes care of her as much as I do. Like, when I have night shift at the hospital, when I'm abroad because I'm speaking at conferences, he keeps her. I see some dads, they would be lost, you know, without the mom for 2 days. My husband, that's no problem. I can leave the kid with him and he's perfectly fine with her.
So how old is she now?
She's going to turn 3 in like 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So she's moving around. She's on the go.
Oh, yeah.
What has that been like over the past few months, both in being at home and having her there with your husband and then you spending time at the hospital?
Yeah, so that's not what happened. So what happened was when the coronavirus crisis started, my husband was in India first, and then he had to go to the US because his brother was had cancer and he's really sick. And
I'm so,
so I find myself in Paris, and I was supposed to go meet him in the US, and he was supposed to come back a few days later. But because of his brother's story, anyway, long story short, I found myself in Paris walking and the daycare closed because of the coronavirus. And I was like, I have to work. And so my parents, they live in the south of France now, but my mom has a cancer and she gets treated in Paris. So she has to come.
Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I know. That's a difficult part. But she gets chemotherapy every 3 weeks in Paris. And so when she came to Paris for her chemo, I was like, you have to take Clara because I cannot work and keep her. I can't stay home. The hospital requested us. You couldn't take vacation. Mm-hmm. That was forbidden. So they left with Clara and they still have her. And that was on March 11th. And so my husband was able to come back 2 weeks later because Clara was south of France and because the coronavirus was everywhere and the daycare was closed and my husband has remote work. But basically, if we were to have taken her back, so two things. The first one is my husband would have had to keep her all the time in a tiny apartment in Paris while having to do remote work. That would have been just horrible for both of them. Clara would not have been happy like that. And if I had taken her back, I would have exposed her to the coronavirus through my work. She would not have been able to see my mom when my mom comes to Paris for her chemo because my mom, her cancer is also in the lungs. She has 10 metastases in the lungs. So basically, if she gets COVID, like she dies. I mean, there's no other way. Clara is also my mom's treatment in a way because it's her only grandchild. So what we decided is to leave her with them. My parents are super happy to have her. They have a farm with a dog and cats and horses and flowers and a garden with strawberries and, you know, and like a little bike. And she has two adults taking care of her 24/24 and she's in heaven. I remember at some point being like, well, you know, it's been weeks when the adult department that I was working for just for the coronavirus closed. I was like, well, I'm going to take her back. And I remember that one girl at the hospital, she looked at me and she's like, Cecile, you're horrible. And I'm like, what? She's like, why would you take her back? She's happy with your parents in heaven. And you want to put her in a tiny apartment in Paris while the daycare is closed and you're walking? What's wrong with you? And I was like, but I'm her mom. And so, and I was like, well.
But she's off on holiday. She's in the south of France.
So I called my parents and I was like, well, what should we do? I mean, I had my dad on the phone and because my mom was like, yeah, I mean, if you want her back, take her back. And I was like, Dad, what does mom want? You know, because once I take her back, she cannot see Clara. So for me, it's a difficult decision because if I take back Clara, she might not ever see her grandmother again. So my dad is like, well, of course, if you ask your mom, she would love to keep Clara. Like it's been maintaining her and she's happy every day to have her. So I was like, okay, you know, it's difficult for me because we miss her, but she's still there and she's going to stay there until the end of August. And so I got to see her with a mask 10 days ago for the first time after 2 months. Wow. And it was such an experience. So I've been missing her. At the beginning, I was feeling guilty because I was like, wow, like the house is put away. Like I can sleep. Like I can sleep until 11 in the morning. Like I can eat whatever I want, you know? So I felt guilty for not missing her. And then I missed her. And then I felt guilty for not taking her back. And then I just missed her. And then I see her every day on FaceTime and she's changing so fast and her hair is growing and her legs are like growing and she's speaking so much better. And I miss her so bad. So when I knew I was going to see her, I was so excited. And I was like, am I see her mom? Like, is my mom her mom? Like, what does she think of me now? Like, who am I for her? And I went there and I was so stressed and my heart was beating. And then, I mean, it was the most beautiful day of my life. When I saw her, of course, like I cried, you know, like a baby. And she was so cute. She did not know what to do with her body. She was so happy. She was just giggling, you know. She was like giggling and moving. And you could see that it was so many emotions for her that she didn't know what to do. She was just giggling. She was like, ha 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 ha, like this, you know. Like, you didn't know if she was gonna cry because she was so happy, or she, if she was laughing, or. And I thought to myself, that never happens in real life, to like not get to see your kid for 2 months. And it allowed me to like step back and miss her so much that I rediscovered her. And the joy that I had and the love that I had for her on that day, all of it was worth it. Just for that day, all the stuff that I've been going through, missing her so bad and crying at home, if that was to experience that moment, then I'm so happy. And then every parent should actually experience that, because I think once you have that in your life, it's like the day where the kid is born. It's like an overflow of love. You don't forget about it. I mean, you love your kid, but you get to like rediscover it and re-experience it. And it's really beautiful. Yeah, it was amazing. After, when I left, it was horrible. I cried for like hours and it was so hard and everything. But the moment that I was with her was like amazing, and she understood everything. She just knew, like, she was so cute, and she was like picking up flowers for me and asking me where my house was. And but she knew. I don't know. I could see that she knew. And then at the end, I told her, well, you know, you're going to go back with your grandparents, and we're going to go back to seeing each other on the phone, and then I will come and see you later. And you could see that something was like weird, but she's like, okay, mom, like, okay, you know, and giving me kisses. And so, yeah, that was crazy.
I'm speechless. I'm so inspired by your story, by your resilience, by just everything.
So my mom has been having cancer for 3 years now, and it's quite amazing that she's still here. I mean, she has like metastases everywhere, and it's really bad. And to be honest, 3 years is already a miracle. And so over the 3 years, it really puts life in perspective. And I had to learn, like, I went through everything. I mean, I've cried so many, you know, weeks, and I've been so desperate. But then over time, you learn the value of life. You learn that everything is impermanent. You learn that they're worse. And I learned to be grateful, because even if my mom is gone in a month, of course, I'm going to be devastated. But I was lucky enough to have a mom up until now who I get along super good with, who got to know Clara, who got to teach me all of those things. And some people don't have that. Like, they don't, you know, maybe their mom died earlier, and maybe their mom, you know, was never there for them. And so I'm so lucky for that. And then through the disease, even though it's horrible, you get to communicate on what you want to. I got to spend so much quality time with her. And yes, everything is impermanent in life. Everything, even my daughter, even our friends, even us. And so it takes a lot of time. But I think that now, of course, I still have emotions, and I'm still mad, and I'm still sad and everything. But I learned that you have to go with life. You can't, there's stuff that you cannot control. And my mom's disease, I can't control. Like, we're trying to have medicine, do everything we can to like make her live longer. But I'm not God, I'm not the universe, and I don't have power over her life. But I have the power to make the time I have with her the best. And then when she's gone, it's going to be very difficult. But then I have to like go on with life, and everything she taught me, then I have to take it for myself and carry it with me and apply it to my life. I'm able to apply that to like a lot of things. All your relationships with husband and kids and friends. And
what you've given her, the opportunity to spend time with your daughter, is such a gift. I mean, this past few months, it's such a period of uncertainty, and it's difficult for so many. But I do think some of the silver linings are examples like the work that you're doing is incredible, and the opportunity for your mom to spend time with her. It's so inspiring. And I mean, like you were saying, you're constantly innovating and thinking about how to do more and to do better. And I think when I first reached out to you, I was really inspired to see like what you were doing for the virus. I had no idea this entire backstory of how you've been juggling all these different pieces. I was initially reaching out because I saw that you just on the side had opened up this entire room of 3D printers because the hospitals were missing pieces and you were going to go print them.
Yeah, we did.
How did that come about?
Yeah, so that was quite funny. So because I'm in tech, when the crisis started, I had a lot of independent makers contacting me, telling me the hospital is lacking equipment. We can print some of it. And I was seeing all those makers talking to me. And I was like, well, they're all working on different projects at different speed. and we don't have time. Like, they should be working together, and the first one who get the best prototype, you know, everybody follows, and that's how it's going to work the best. I was starting to coordinate a bit those initiatives on my side. And then on the other side, I have a friend who's a surgeon. He was building the project of buying 60 3D printers and putting them in a Parisian hospital and printing medical device. And he was struggling with it because he couldn't find the money, and he was just pushing and pushing. Somehow we got to talk, and I was like, I know the people. I mean, I know the big director of the Parisian hospitals. I have contacts in the ministries because of all my conferences and all my like crazy jobs everywhere. Like, I know I have a, and Sandbox, you know, I have a huge network in France. So I was like, your project is great. I'm doing this on my side. Let's just write these big emails with like everybody in the loop. And so I wrote this big email, and I was so, my God, when I sent it, I was like, what did I just do? I wrote this big email, and I included the Ministry of Industry, the Ministry of Economy, the Ministry of Healthcare, the head of all Parisian hospitals, deans of faculties. And my email was like black and red. I was like, nothing is happening. We're lacking material. People are dying. This initiative is there. We need 1.4 million euro by tomorrow, like within 24 hours, because we have all those 60 3D printers waiting to be delivered. We have the location. My friend, the surgeon, he's an expert in 3D. He's the right leader for that project. And then at the end, I was like, so thank you for A, approving the project, two, finding 1.4 million within 24 hours. And my friend was like, oh my God, you're crazy. And he was like, you have to like explain them more. I was like, no, I don't have to explain them more. All they need to do is understand that they're saying yes to something great and find the money, because we don't know how to do that. And I was like, my God, people are going to think I'm nuts. Like, they're going to laugh at me. Like, they're going to tell me, Cecile, like, what the fuck, you know? And then I know other people were pushing, but 24 hours later, the project was approved. And we were like, oh, wow. Like, we're dreaming, you know. So they actually found the money, the 60 3D printers. After, it got a bit complicated because the French administration, is they wanted to approve all the medical devices, they wanted to have a look at everything, they were a pain with everything. So we still printed a lot of stuff, but there was a lot that we couldn't do just because of regulations. I don't understand. I mean, when there's a crisis, is it better to have nothing, or is it better to have something that works but it's not perfect? Like, it's better to have something that works but not perfect. But we're still able to do quite a few things. Yeah, that was quite a ride.
What did that look like in practice? You guys have these printers going at all hours of the day and night. Are you scanning the pieces that you do have to make replicas of them? Yeah. Almost like supply chain work.
So my friend who's a surgeon, I know him because we work together in the healthcare simulation department. We've helped him gather money to build a small 3D lab in his hospital. So he really knows about 3D, and he's working with a startup that does a 3D medical device. So that startup, they put all their people working 24/24 basically on the 60 3D printers. I mean, we were basically on my side, like I was gathering the need on the field. I was gathering the doctors that we needed to develop the devices, because I'm a ER physician, but I don't know much about ICU devices and all those stuff. But I have my network of doctors. I would get the doctors, I would get what we need on the field. Remember one day, like when they delivered the 60 3D printers, my friend calls me and he's like, Cecile, there's going to be boxes everywhere. There's no trash can. How are we going to do that? I mean, it's trucks of paper boxes. And I was like, Okay, let me call the City Hall of Paris. And so I have one contact, and I call the guy and I say, I need your help. We need the cleaning department of Paris to come with those huge trash cans. I will need two for tomorrow, because it was the next day. And the guy was like, yeah, hold on. And then 15 minutes later, he calls me up and he's like, okay, Cecile, I got you the head of the cleaning department of Paris. And then I got the guy on the phone, and then, yes, ma'am, at what hour, when, how can we help? I was like, okay, be there at this hour, and then they were just here. Okay.
Incredible.
Like, that was incredible. It was like, are we dreaming or are we not? Like, is this really happening? My friend was more on the 3D, you know, technical side, and I was more about just making anything that we needed happen. It's like, what do you need? I'll just make it happen. So yeah, it was quite amazing. It was quite amazing.
Have you had other cities, countries, medical professionals reaching out to you, having seen what you've done, the fact that Europe is, say, 10 days ahead of the States?
Yeah.
Have you had people reaching out to you to talk about how you can replicate those efforts if it's relevant?
Yeah. So we're in contact right now with some country in Africa. So basically the thing is, now that the crisis is over, we don't need it anymore. And we are all like, well, okay, we did this, but it would be too bad that this just vanishes right now. So two of the people involved in the project were trying to build that ICU 3D kit for emerging countries, because in the States, in the rest of Europe, people can order what they need. But countries like India, Africa, South America, they don't have the means. So we're trying to put online every device that we did. We're trying to put the link for the open source files. If you want to have an ICU made of like 3D things, here is a website where you can find what you need. So we're trying to do that. It's not fully done yet, but that's what we're trying to do. So at least it can help other people. Maybe it helped France a tiny bit, to be honest. I mean, we didn't change the course of things, but it did help a bit. But it would be better if we knew that it would help other people as well.
Everything that you've learned through this process as a mom, as a pediatric ER physician, what advice would you give to parents that might be listening to this right now that don't necessarily have your experience but want the best for their kids, and they're multitasking, they're doing their work from home, their kids have maxed out on all the shows that they can watch?
Oh, yeah.
What advice would you give to people that might be listening?
So it's different in France and the States, because in the States, I believe schools are still closed. But as soon as the school reopened, like, put your kid in school. So a lot of parents are afraid right now. But what we know now, and we have the data, I know a lot of mistakes were done at the beginning of the crisis because we did not know the virus. We were discovering everything. A lot of people think that we're wrong, but now it's been months. We know the virus much better. Of course, we're still discovering things, but we understand what it does with kids. And we know that kids get it much less than adults. It's a small portion of the kids who get it. When they get it, they don't get severe forms of the disease. The severe forms of the disease are extremely rare, much more rare than like the risk of going outside and being run over by a car. I mean, it's really such a tiny, tiny, tiny portion among all the people who have coronavirus that parents should not be worried. I mean, it's really the exception. And usually kids who develop severe forms, they have other diseases or they are obese. So, of course, in the US, you have a lot of kids who are obese, right? The risk is a bit higher. But even when they have severe forms of the disease, the vast majority, they do not die from it. They recover perfectly. When you look at all the deaths worldwide, so it's quite fishy. We don't really have the right numbers, but we believe it's between 20 and 40 kids, okay? For more than half of those kids, you realize that there is no information on the deaths. So they tell you that it's coronavirus, but you have no idea if it's really the coronavirus. It might have been something else. It's not because you have the coronavirus that you die from it. Maybe a kid, it was like he had a massive surgery and he died from the disease he had, and he happened to have the coronavirus. He did not die from the coronavirus. So there's a lot of online publication, scientific publication, where they report children's deaths, but there's no details. So we don't know if it's the coronavirus. And some other kids who are in this list, we know they actually did not die from coronavirus. So worldwide, it's probably like maybe 10, maybe not even 10 kids. Maybe it's like 3 or 4. So, you know, you can't. I mean, how many kids die per day of so many other diseases? So the risk is really low. And then after, there's a Kawasaki syndrome that they can get a few weeks later that we've been hearing about. And this is nothing new. We know that syndrome. It happens with other viruses, with other bacteria. It's nothing new, and it's not specific to the coronavirus. The kids can get it with other types of cold. So you can't stress about it, because otherwise you would be stressing every day of your life because your kids gets cold all the time. Because it's a pandemic, you have more kids who have that Kawasaki-like syndrome, but they all recover, all of them. Even if they have it, they go to the hospital, a few days later, they're out of the hospital. There is one kid who supposedly died in France, actually, and we try to look into the case, and it's missing information. So again, we don't even know if he really died from that or from another disease. the risk of the coronavirus for kids is super, 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 super low. We know they don't get it much, and we know that they don't transmit it much. There's been studies of kids who have been in contact with like 100 persons and nobody had it from the kid because they have a low viral charge in their body. They don't really contaminate other people. So there's no risk in putting kids in school. The only thing that schools need to do is protect the teachers that are at risk of developing a severe form of coronavirus. So if you have teachers that are old, obese, they have cardiovascular or lungs disease, then yes, those people should definitely wear a mask or not work. But there's no problem with your kid. Like, stop worrying about your kids. Your kids are fine. Coronavirus, we're lucky. It's not a disease that affects kids in a serious way. And I think because so many mistakes were made at the beginning of the crisis, today, a lot of doctors, they're scared to say it's okay with kids. We need to have the courage to say, hey, guys, we have the data. Your kids are fine. Don't worry about your kids. Put them back in school. They've had enough of you. You know, they've been seeing the parents for months. I mean, the parents are nuts. The kids are nuts. They can't take it anymore. They need something else. Like, put them back in school. Like, have them see their friends, you know, even if they're having masks. A lot of people are like, yeah, but what about the psychological consequences of like my kid wearing a mask in school and having to do the social distancing? You know what? When you see your friends, they're already doing it and they adapt much more easily than adults, because for kids, his life, whatever happens in it, is normal. For adults, we're able to realize that it's not normal. But for a kid, he doesn't know anything else. So for a kid, everything that happens in his life until he's a teen, it's normal for him. He doesn't know any better. Like, hey, this is what people do. Okay, I'll do the same thing. So they adapt. The parents are stressed, but they shouldn't, because they're going to put their stress on the kid, and that's what's going to go wrong. But the kids by itself, they're fine. They adapt. They adapt very well.
Cecile, thank you so much for taking time to tell us about your story and tell us everything. This is so, so inspiring. Thank you.
You're welcome. I feel like I talk too much.
It was perfect. And I love your energy, your enthusiasm. It's really contagious. So thank you so much. I wish the best for your mom and for your parents and your husband. And I can't wait to come back to Paris and sit down and have a glass of wine and talk in person.
Yes. And if anyone has questions, feel free to give my email address. I'm happy to, you know.
Perfect. I will do that. I will do that. Because I think what you've just said about recommendations for kids will put a lot of people's minds at ease. I've had lots of different Zooms and phone calls, and you hear the kids in the background. And I think everyone, parents, yeah, teachers, kids are all restless.
Yeah.
So this is inspiring. Thank you so much. I'm sending a big hug to Paris, and we'll talk soon.
Same to you and your family.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.